Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. This is the third and final episode in the series with Ramis Kent, covering Islam and Earth Care. If you haven't heard the first two episodes, you want to begin there before listening to this one. Or if you were with me when the original episodes were released, you might want to go back and catch them as a refresher. You'll find links to both of those in the show notes. Much of our conversation this time is about being responsible for our own lives and for having dignity and respect for others. I appreciate this conversation for the openness that Ramis brought and the space that we created in which to hold the discussion. The topics weren't easy to discuss, but needed to be covered. Thankfully, Mr. Kent is a gifted speaker who brought patience to the interview, even as we spoke for many, many hours. If you enjoy this podcast, help me keep it on the air. Go to thepermaculturepodcast.com/support to find out how to make a one-time or ongoing contribution. Now then, on to Ramis Kent. I'll join you afterwards with some final thoughts.
How can a merciful God allow these horrible things to happen?
Yeah, I mean, it's like that question of evil is like the theodicy, right? Like, why do bad things happen to good people, right? Or why is there evil in the world? And if there was a God, why would he allow these things to happen? I think the thing you have to ask yourself, and this gets back to what we were saying before about, like, struggle. You know, you would ask this question, or what does jihad mean? What is this concept? How does it apply? It means struggle. But the greatest struggle that anyone can undertake is the struggle against themselves. Now, you see this idea of, okay, well, what happens when a person fails to deal with their own evil, right? What happens when a person fails to be able to deal with certain aspects of themselves that if it's allowed to get out of control, like what results from it? Well, there are very clear answers that are given in the, you know, in the Quran. There's an ayah in the surah called Ashura, or the chapter called Ashura. And it says, and whatever of misfortune befalls you, it is because of what your hands have earned, right? And he pardons much, he being God. And then there's one in the surah, the chapter called Arum, and it says, corruption has appeared on the land and sea by reason of what your hands have earned, right? That Allah, that the deity may make them taste a part of that which they have done in order that they may return. Right. So the idea is that, well, look, if there's anything that's happening that you don't like, you're the one that did it. Like, God's like, I didn't do it. You did it. Right. So why isn't the finger pointed at you? Like, why isn't the finger pointed at man? So if man is the responsible, if humans are the ones responsible for creating the mess, then why isn't the finger pointed back at themselves as saying, OK, well, like, this is what a mature person would do. If you made a mess, you would clean it up. Right. You acknowledge the fact, number one, you acknowledge the fact that you made the mess and then you clean it up. And so this is part of sort of the need to sort of advocate for or acknowledge your own agency in being able to change the things that we don't like that are happening in the world, and that we have been endowed with the ability to do that. And that if we don't take advantage of the ability to be able to change the things that we don't like about the world, that's not God's fault. You've been given the tools. You're not putting them to use. This even plays into, you know, when you have times where people experience oppression. One of the things we talk a lot about, rights and responsibilities, you know, within the Islamic tradition, and that even your own self has certain rights, right? That there are rights that your body has over you that have to be acknowledged and recognized. And that when you don't acknowledge the rights of your body, right, of your own self, that the failure to recognize those rights results in unfavorable outcomes. And one of the things that a person has to acknowledge is that they have the right to defend themselves, right? So if someone is trying to do something to you that they should not be doing, that you have a responsibility to prevent that person from oppressing you. And actually, that's a tradition that is attributed, or hadith, a quote that's attributed to the Prophet Muhammad. This is a paraphrase. If you find that there are people that are being oppressed and there are people that are oppressing, he said to help them both. And so his companions, like, they heard him say that, and they were like, okay, well, we understand the need to help people who are being oppressed. But how do we help the oppressor? And the prophet said to them, by preventing them or by stopping them from their oppressing, right? By preventing them, by stopping them from their oppressing people. So there is a call to not allow for that to occur. And especially if it's happening to you. So there comes a point where, and I think this is one of the reasons why, you know, within the Islamic tradition, there is no allowance for offensive warfare, right? That aggression, like that aggression is something that is seen as being odious. But the need to defend oneself is definitely advocated for, is because if you don't defend yourself, then the conditions that lead to the spread of oppression, right, is the fault of the one who allowed for the oppression to occur in the first place. We know that those who may be inclined to oppress people, that there is a fault or a flaw within them that they're not able to overcome or control, which causes them to do that to others. But you, if you have a sense of the need to oppose that, you can be the agent by which that oppression is stopped, right? So that's something else that has to be sort of put into the mix. And I think it very much has a lot to do with, you know, in talking about this need to take up this activity of repairing the earth or for advocating for the earth. It's very much a part of the call that's being made here to engage in this activity, is that there's a lot of work that needs to be done in preventing the oppression of the earth, you know, and of living systems, that there are things that need to be done in order to restore the integrity and the viability and the functionality of these systems that we rely upon.
And that goes back to that idea that we are stewards of this earth, of our home.
Right. And that's part of it. You're sort of like the sheriff, so to speak. Human beings are the ones that make sure that the order is maintained. And of course, that has its challenges. But first and foremost, in order for that job to be performed well, you have to first get yourself in order. Because if you're not in order, how are you going to do that for anything that's outside of yourself? So there's a certain amount of work that has to be done on the one that's charged with the job. Once that necessary work has been performed, then you can do those things outside of yourself.
It was something that took me a long time to come to, was realizing how important self-care is in my ability to take good action.
And that's definitely something that has to be understood, is that, again, you in and of yourself, there's certain things that you sort of have to provide yourself with. You have to acknowledge the fact that your body, yourself, has rights over you, and that you have to perform a service to rendering those rights that are due to your person. And that, again, once those are understood and you have rendered those rights to yourself and to your person, then you can extend that out to others. And unless there's an acknowledgement of the importance of doing that, then, you know, you've got a problem. Like, you've already started off on the wrong foot. And then pretty much everything else after that, it's like, you know, the foundation of a building. If you don't create a sturdy, well-built foundation, then anything else that you try to build on top of that, it's going to fail eventually. And that care that one has to show themselves, you have to be very sure that you're doing that and you see the importance of doing that. And then, again, it can move beyond and outside of yourself.
If you don't take care of yourself, how can you take care of others? If you aren't in a place to love yourself, how can you express love to someone else?
Right.
I'm not a big fan of Maslow's hierarchy because I think it winds up putting too much focus on the self. And it's easy to say, well, my needs aren't being met, so I can't help anybody else. I'm within some of the traditions that I've gone through with education and other pieces. There's an idea that you need to have a calling or something greater than yourself that you work towards. It's a big conversation within environmental education, is that we should be teaching children how to find what it is they want to do in the world, and then be able to help them then use that to find a right livelihood or to make a career out of that interest so that they can live a good, well-balanced life.
Yeah, the Maslow thing. I mean, I often refer to Maslow's hierarchy just because, you know, I think there's certain things, the way that he sort of laid out kind of this logical progression of needs, it's useful at least in trying to, you know, set up certain arguments or start certain discussions about identifying what exactly those needs are and how they're ordered. Of course, there's certain caveats, or that discussion about the care of the self takes place within a particular context. It's not absolute. That has to be contextualized against something else, because you're not alone in the world. You're in a world that's occupied by other beings, you know, by other people, by other life forms, by other any number of things. And what you do has, you know, ramifications. It has an impact on so many other things outside of yourself. It has to be balanced. You know, you can't be extreme in either respect, either completely forgetting yourself and allowing for yourself to sort of wither away or be neglected. But by the same token, you can't allow for your own sense of self-importance to eclipse an understanding that there's a need to also consider, you know, others. It's something that you have to find a proper balance between the two. You know, and that's the trick. I mean, everything in life is about just trying to strike a proper balance. And I mean, that's actually one of the, there's a quote that's attributed to the cousin and the son-in-law of the Prophet Muhammad, a man named Ali ibn Abi Talib. And he said, this again is a paraphrase, he said, beware of the two extremes. He said, doing too much and doing too little. So there are two extremes. There are these two poles. And it's a matter of trying to position yourself as much as possible within the middle. I mean, if anything, that is sort of the description of Islam. Islam is described as being the middle way. We're said to be the community of the middle way. And that's the goal, is to try to find out what that golden mean is in everything that we do.
Have you ever read Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning?
No, I'm not familiar.
If I remember right, he was contemporary with Maslow. He wrote from his experiences as someone who had been imprisoned in a concentration camp. I'm just going from my own recollection, so I apologize to anyone who knows this work well if I got this a little bit off. But his was about how he could watch people who were in the greatest of health, but because they had nothing to keep them going, just withered away within short periods. In his work, it's about, well, as I say, that finding something that's kind of greater than yourself. But I find that Frankl's work isn't as easy to encapsulate, because Maslow gives you this nice diagram and this nice hierarchy that you can just kind of roll with.
Right, right. Picture speaks a thousand words, right?
For me, I wish that Frankl's ideas had caught on a little bit more, because when individually, I don't think either one is enough, but together they provide a very nice framework for being able to live a balanced life.
You know, and I think that's the thing, is that you're always different people. I think they can give you some really useful insights into, you know, any number of things, but no one sort of has the completely total comprehensive view to all of it. You know, I mean, all of our perspectives are limited in a, you know, to a certain extent, although some people have, I think, a much, much better idea as to what's happening than others. And they can help you gain a very useful understanding as to how to think about things. But I think it's just, you know, you have an understanding that there's always something to be gained by looking at a number of perspectives, and it helps to round out the total, complete, comprehensive understanding of a particular phenomenon.
Throughout all of this conversation, I've really enjoyed the way that you're able to articulate all of this, that there's this nice balance of academic versus a practical practitioner, both of the faith and permaculture, the way you blended all of this together.
It's funny, I think when I first was exposed to permaculture and then really started to, you know, find out discover the intellectual underpinnings, there was so much about Islam that immediately occurred to me. There's so many similarities, and it's not difficult to find ways to link the two. I think this is one of the reasons why, especially with a lot of the work that I find myself doing and many of the areas I find myself working in, I work in a lot in the, you know, the Middle East and North Africa, and worked in East Africa, you know, Central and South Asia. I've also worked in Southeast Asia. I happen to work a lot with Muslim populations. I just got back from teaching a course in Yemen, in Hadramaut, Yemen. And I first taught a course there with Jeff Lawton about 2 years ago, a little over 2 years ago, almost 3 years ago. And we went back to teach a second course. And also we have quite a lot of project work that's proposed for that area. And in talking to people there about permaculture, and like in framing it within this context and talking about it, relating it to the Islamic tradition, it's something that they get right away. I mean, even something like the food forest concept, you know, the edible forest garden. They've had that idea within sort of within that part of the world for a very long time. That's what an oasis is, right? An oasis is a food forest. It's an edible forest garden. It's a food forest for an arid or a hyper-arid or semi-arid setting. And I think a lot of people don't realize that the oasis was something that was created. That's a very sort of purpose-built assembly of plants and animals within a very concentrated area to be able to make best use of the available resources. And it's an idea that many of them would sort of refer back to some of their kind of cultural or historical heritage and sort of, in a way, revive some of these knowledges. I remember that first course we did, one of the agricultural engineers that was in the class happened to grab a book of translated South Arabian poetry that had talked about, in the poetry, it would talk about the things that were planted in the garden. You'll also see some of these references made within the Quran itself. And a lot of the poetry that you'll see written among the Arabs and just generally among those people in places that have historically been Muslim, many of those writings are very much about the landscapes, right? It's about nature. It's about the gardens or the crop fields or what have you. There's a very strong tie to that sees the importance of living systems, of the natural world. And again, how these things are metaphors for how they can understand their faith better or have a better understanding as to the divine, you know, the nature of the divine. It's a very powerful vehicle to revive some of those traditions that unfortunately I think have been neglected, and especially in the sort of relatively recent history of Islam and the Muslims.
And that speaks to what you said earlier about how some of this idea of stewardship and care for the earth has gotten lost recently.
I think, unfortunately, a lot of what has been attributed to or is accounted for, at least in the West, as at what's understood to be Islam, strangely enough, it actually comes from some of the more radical kind of sociopolitical constructs that were created in Europe, funnily enough. So if you look at a lot of what was found in, you know, Marxism, for example, I think there are a lot of the ideas that were found within Marxism that were sort of transplanted into, at least there was sort of quasi-Islamic sort of language and ideas that were fused with some of these more radical elements that came out of some of the more recent Western political traditions, as I was saying, like Marxism. The funny thing is, how do you reconcile the fact that, okay, well, one is very much about acknowledging the existence of a God and, you know, and all the ideas that are attached to it. How do you reconcile mating it to something that doesn't recognize the existence of a God, that is atheistic and very much sort of a materialist, I guess, it's dialectical materialism. Is that correct? It comes out of that tradition?
I would have to look that up to be sure.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it's the whole kind of dialectical materialism and all of these ideas, which are, if you were to take these traditions in their totality, you would find that there are a lot of things that are just, they're not reconcilable. And they're completely inconsistent with one another. So there are, of course, certain, you know, political considerations that have come into play that have sort of muddied the waters a bit. And then also you have a lot of the traditional structures that used to be in place, which were how people were trained intellectually, you know, how they came to understand the world, that were dismantled and undermined and sort of replaced with these other institutions and these other ways of thinking that have divorced a lot of people from having the proper understanding of this tradition.
They become part of the cultural tradition as opposed to the faith tradition.
Yeah. Like, you can't talk about the recent history of what we call the Muslim world without talking about the emergence of industrial economies, without talking about the emergence of free market capitalism or communism or the Cold War or the discovery of petroleum, the adoption of consumerism and globalization and all of these things. These are non-trivial factors that very much come into the conversation. I mean, if you look at, for example, you know, the changes that have occurred within the Gulf itself over the, you know, since the discovery of oil, you know, be it petroleum or natural gas, I mean, they've seen more change in the past 70, 80, 90 years than they have in the last 2000. But very few people are aware of that. And to the person who is unfamiliar with that history or unfamiliar with what has come out of the adoption of, again, these economic regimes, and then sort of a lot of the geopolitical events or occurrences that have come about as a result of adopting these ways of doing things. It's just something that you can't dismiss. I think anybody who wants to be honest about, you know, what's occurred in that part of the world and doesn't want to talk about those things doesn't really have an interest in trying to really have a proper understanding as to what has gone on some of these places.
As you and I have talked about, and I don't know if it's going to be a piece that will make it on air because I haven't begun editing all of this since we're still recording. I took a course when I went through my undergrad program in the modern Middle East. It was a history class taught by a political science professor because the historian who was supposed to teach it couldn't, so her husband, the political scientist, stepped in. My final term paper that I had to write was on the formation of Iraq. And as I studied that, it was like, wait, so a lot of what happened in the development of the modern Middle East came out of European colonialism.
Absolutely.
And that it was, if I remember it, I believe it was a British general during World War I or World War II. My apologies, it's been like 15 years since I studied this. He had drawn a map of how to align the Middle East in a way that would have allowed the different tribal peoples their own countries and access to resources and ports and everything else. And then when it came time to actually kind of like get out and let go of a lot of the colonialism, it just became, some administrator said, well, this makes the most sense to us. This is what's going to happen.
Right.
Understanding that impact, well, as you and I talked about in the setup for this, and again, that piece won't be a part of this conversation, was about that understanding the way that history impacts over time, having an evolutionary theory of history, if you will, that event A leads to event B that leads to event C. Like looking at that goes back to that, like with permaculture, you need to have this long view. And if we want to look at the land and what has happened to it over a long period of time, you know, were there any refineries here 150 years ago that might have left some kind of industrial impacts, things like that? Well, if we look at history and the cultures that are involved in these different places, we can see how we got to the place where we are now. But if we're ignorant of how these things developed, it's very easy to go, ah, well, these people or this country, they're not deserving of this, that, or the other because they don't know how to handle it. And it becomes this in-group, out-group kind of thing where, well, as we were talking earlier, you can lead to an oppressive position in the world.
You know, I was just thinking of, something else I was just talking about. I think, you know, one of the things I often find, and this is sort of a pattern of behavior that you'll find that certain people exhibit, especially folks who are very reluctant to have these kinds of conversations, is that sort of the dismissiveness and the trivialization that you'll often find people show towards discussing some of these things. I mean, it's sort of like the worst kind of like an intellectual laziness and arrogance. There's also like a sense of entitlement. You sort of have arrogated to yourself the ability to determine what things are and aren't worthy of consideration. And whether or not the thing that you're talking about or the people that you're talking to are given sort of their proper due and being able to get a fair shake in discussing a matter, it doesn't matter because you're bored or it makes you uncomfortable or it challenges your understanding of what may be occurring, you know, with this particular matter that's being discussed. You don't want to discuss it. Right. It's a type of cowardice. Right. So I mean, for me, the thing that sort of occurred to me was like, OK, well, if this thing is so beneath you and it's just so stupid, and if the explanation that's been given here is so weak and you're that smart, then it should be easy enough to dismantle and you can set me aright rather than dismissing it. Right. But that's not what happens. It's not what happens. It's just simply I'm not talking about that. And unfortunately, it's like, so then we end up sort of falling into these cartoonish like tropes about sort of pigeonholing certain groups of people and, you know, this really gross kind of stereotyping. And It was just disgusting to me because it's a type of rudeness that people mistake for strength. It's a really disgusting type of like bad manners. That's just an indicator. It's just an indicator of like the poor character of people. So you won't do me the courtesy of having a serious conversation about a matter. So what you're going to do is you're going to trivialize it and you're going to dismiss it rather than talking about it. And somehow this dismissal and this trivialization is an indication of intelligence, which I never understood that. Because if you're so intelligent, then let's have the discussion. And if my argument is stupid, then you can very easily take it apart. But it's not about the information. This gets back to what we were talking about earlier. It's about the narrative. And if my explanation of what's happening disrupts or undermines the narrative that sort of keeps a certain order in place or sort of permits a certain course of action from being maintained, then it's a problem. What ends up happening is maybe you find out that these people aren't the people that you thought they were, and you aren't the person that you thought you were. So if you aren't who you thought you were and they aren't who you thought they were, well, who are you and who are they, right? But that's kind of frightening because if you find out you're not the person that you thought you were, then, you know, the world kind of gets turned upside down. Then you have a bit of an identity crisis and you're like, okay, well, what does that mean? And there's so much of this that's discussion about Islam and who are the Muslims and who are these people and who are that people, that having an honest discussion about that stuff is it's really confronting. And a lot of people who aren't prepared to have that conversation because they might end up finding out that they aren't who they thought they were.
And that was one of the things that you and I spoke about before we even started the last conversation, is we wound up having that conversation about race and identity, that kind of existential crisis that can come when everything that you know and understand falls apart.
Yeah.
It's easy to understand how someone can become vitriolic and hateful when they have nothing else to hold on to.
Right. That's exactly the problem that people end up being confronted with, is that sort of that hate and that vitriol is what keeps people warm at night. And it's how they define everything. And, you know, a person who spoke very powerfully to this, beautifully to this, and was one of my favorite authors, is James Baldwin. You know, and James Baldwin talked about this in The Fire Next Time. And he said, and again, paraphrasing, he said, I think one of the reasons why people are so reluctant to sort of relinquish their hatred and relinquish this kind of vitriolic opposition to certain groups of people, and they're so slow to give up certain ways of thinking, is because if they do it and they arrive at this place that they can no longer rely on this crutch, the thing that they're left with is pain, right? And who wants to deal with the pain? Who wants to deal with the pain of finding out that you're wrong, you know? And that's difficult. And so, you know, it's like, so you're constantly, you know, people are constantly doing things to sort of dodge the reality of the pain of this mistaken way of seeing things. You're constantly trying to keep up this charade, you know, this masquerade of what you think is happening. It's like kind of this delusional view of things. I mean, one of the people that I'm also, you know, really big, it's kind of a hero of mine, is Robert F. Williams. He wrote a book in the 1960s called, or late 50s, called Negroes with Guns, right? And this is the guy that sort of was the inspiration behind the creation of actually the Black Panther Party and the Deacons for Defense. And there were a number of groups that had sort of advocated for, you know, self-defense against, you know, a lot of the racist forces in the South. And one of the things that he said was that he had come to the conclusion that racism, he says, it was a type of mass psychosis. And so if one understands sort of the racist worldview as a type of mental illness, then, you know, this is, then you start to get something, a very, you know, kind of like a mass delusion. Then you start to kind of have a bit of a different understanding of the people that you're dealing with. And actually, and if anything, it also, I think, causes you, and this is something that James Baldwin addresses in The Fire Next Time, it also causes you to actually have a type of sympathy for the people that hold these views, because they're not able to recognize the illness. And that one of the things he had said in this book was like, you know, you have to accept these people with love, because, you know, that's the thing that it just adds to the pain, that they don't have something to take the edge off of this hatred that they have within them that's causing them ultimately a lot of pain.
And there's two pieces to this that come to mind. And one is that if you come to a point where you're ready to reject those things, if your perspective matures past a zealous clinging to your ideals, and if you're part of this group that emphasizes in-group versus out-group kind of thinking, well, if you reject the group that you're in, who is going to be there to help you handle that pain? Who do you have that you can reach out to who will support you through that process? I understand how that can be very reinforcing. Recently, in the last 2 years or so, I'm coming to understand the privileges that I've had in life just by virtue of when and where I was born and who my parents were. And as I said in part of our conversation before we began, I wasn't raised in a way where race was ever really an issue. And I realized, though, that idea of being colorblind is one of my privileges.
It's funny you say that because someone had put up a Facebook post about, I don't know if you're familiar with this, there's an experiment that's often done to sort of demonstrate sort of that whole kind of racist phenomenon by kind of discriminating against people or separating people according to eye color, right? So you have people that have blue eyes and then other people have brown eyes, and then some people are prevented from doing things or going places because they have the wrong color eyes. What was interesting was to see the reaction of the people that were being discriminated against. Most of these people were invariably, I think they were pretty much all sort of white. So they had never experienced anything like this before. So the reactions were like amazing to see how upset people were getting. Some of them were so upset that they actually asked for permission to no longer participate in the exercise because it was too upsetting. So it kind of goes into, so now to kind of talk about this idea of being able to opt out because it makes you uncomfortable. And sort of having that as an option is sort of a type of privilege that I think some, you know, people don't recognize as being a privilege. Like the fact that you can just be like, all right, you can tap out and, you know, you can kind of go back to sort of an existence that you don't have to worry about those things anymore. So I think it's, you know, it's sort of that realization is, I think for some people, it's like strange when you could kind of see how that sort of plays out for you, you know, and how that doesn't play out for other people.
I'll have to see if I can find the article and post it in the show notes for this conversation. But it was a sociologist wrote the article about like just privilege from an American perspective. And it's like, well, what if you go into a store in the United States and ask to speak with a manager, how likely is it that when you go into the store, that manager is going to be similar to your socioeconomic background, your skin color, your cultural upbringing? And where my thought goes with this, though, is how those kinds of understandings also relate to our conversation of religion and in-groups and out-groups and the discrimination that comes with it. And how, well, the ignorance, if you will, that someone can operate from by not engaging their personal ignorance and seeking to look past it. I don't know if you use the language or not, or if it was just what I'm thinking of because of the note that I wrote when you said it, but when you just dismiss that other person, it's actually one of my biggest pet peeves in the world is being dismissed.
Right. No, absolutely.
If I extend my hand to shake someone's hand and they don't, without offering a reason, or if they just, you know, look at my hand and laugh and turn away, that to me is one of the most awful things that I think someone can do to someone else, because it says, and I don't just mean the handshake, but just being dismissed by someone in general, because it says, you're not worthy enough of my attention as a human being.
Right, right.
And it's completely dehumanizing. And I understand how that can lead to more suffering in the world for the person who has it done to them. If they're not in a place where, as we said earlier about that self-care, where they love themselves enough to realize the place that other person may be coming from, not to recognize them.
I think it just goes back to, again, failing to have enough regard for another person's human dignity. And at the moment that one fails to acknowledge that, this is when the problems start. And that every sort of interpersonal problem that could be said to occur is a result of the failure to recognize another person's dignity, their being worthy of consideration. And then the moment that goes out the window, then everything else breaks down pretty quickly. Because if you have a regard for a person, if you have a regard for another person, then these problems that we're talking about tend to not occur. because, you know, you're doing the things, or you're paying attention to the person, or you're regarding them in a manner that is befitting a human.
One of the things that I get into is that what separates us as human beings is so much smaller than what brings us together.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a friend of mine said, we can sit here and have completely diametrically opposed perspectives or arguments for something. But if you and I respect one another enough just to have a dialogue, that I respect you well enough for us to communicate, then yeah, a lot of that stuff goes away. We may not go away, you know, with our views changed, because we may hold on to them, but we at least get a better understanding of the other person. I shared with you a story about my own life about some family members who survived being imprisoned in concentration camps. When they got through that, they were able to overcome that. And what comes through with that, just being human and respecting one another, that they did not turn what happened to them back into anger towards the other people.
That's a really sort of rarefied understanding of things, rarefied understanding of people. It's just understanding that the folks who do the types of things that were done to your family, they're sick. They're sick. And it needs to be recognized as such. Now, there are a number of responses that would, you know, be called for in an effort to try to counter the effects of the sickness. But I think it is recognizing the fact that in some instances, there is a requirement to sort of save people from themselves. But again, it's acknowledging the fact that, you know, these people aren't in their right mind and they need to be seen in that light.
We've covered so many things. We've now, as I add the hours together between the 2 days that we've talked, I think we've logged somewhere between 6 and 6.5 hours of conversation at this point, Ramis. And I'm thankful for it. So to allow you to return to your family with all the time that I've taken you from them, do you have any last thoughts to close out this series of conversations we've had?
Yeah, I think one of the challenges I've been making to especially the audiences or the groups of people that I've had that sort of identify themselves as being Muslim. I mean, one of the challenges I've made to the groups is that we need to become a community that defines itself primarily according to ethics. Again, it needs to be defined primarily by ethics, the ethics that have shaped the foundations of the tradition, the ethics that made it great, you know, because I think, unfortunately, and we can say this about a lot of different things. We can definitely say this about, different types of faith groups. You can say this about, you know, certain political affiliations, is that I think we've so allowed ourselves to descend into this sort of gang or tribal mentality, you know, kind of Crips versus Bloods or Autobots versus Decepticons or, you know, Democrat, Republican, Tory versus Labor, what have you, that we no longer define ourselves according to our ethical sensibilities. You know, I think we've seen this a lot within the confines of Islam, where people are defined by their ethnicity, they're defined by the sort of geographically where they come from, culturally where they come from, things that really have very little to do with ethics or nothing to do with ethics. And that we are ultimately, I think, as human beings, we aren't going to become what we need to become and what we should become if we don't allow ourselves to be defined or moved or guided by ethics. And I think this is where something like a permaculture can become a very powerful vehicle. It's a means by which to revive this sensibility again in people. It's a means by which this understanding that historically may have been had by certain folks, that they no longer have valued this. It's been forgotten. It's been neglected. And I think it's high time that we bring it back because we need it. I think everything that we've seen happening in the world, at least the things that we don't like that are happening in the world, is a result of us no longer valuing ethics, us no longer seeing ethics as being something that matters. These are sort of quaint, outmoded ideas that we don't have time for it. And unfortunately, I believe until we return back to seeing the importance of these things and bringing new life back to these sensibilities, we're in big trouble. We're in big trouble. And I think the way that a lot of these problems are going to end up being resolved, if we don't acknowledge the importance of ethics, it's going to get very ugly. It's already ugly in a lot of places. It's going to get a lot uglier, a lot faster than people think. So it's in our best interest to do what we can to, you know, to revive this sensibility in people again. And I think we'll be a lot better for it.
One of the values of permaculture as a tool for this kind of transformation is that it's a secular system in which we can share in a common language regardless of our background.
Yeah, I think for those people who aren't, you know, who aren't inclined to be an adherent to a particular religion or what have you, I mean, that's not required. I think that the idea of recognizing the importance of ethics is something that covers any and all bases, at least anything that I would consider to be worthy of consideration acknowledges the importance of ethics. Belonging to a particular religious group, affiliating yourself with a particular, you know, a spirit tradition or what have you is not required. The only thing that matters is that you have, you know, that sensibility that recognizing the dignity of things, it matters. And then acting on that recognition of the importance of recognizing the dignity of things, that's something that has to be given new life. And as long as we're in agreement on those things, then, you know, there's a lot of work we can do and there's a lot of work that needs to be done. It's just a matter of doing it.
If we want to build a better world, if we want it to be more peaceful and there to be more good, we have to do good. We have to build a better world. We can't just sit here and talk about it. And you mentioned earlier about the importance of Bill Mollison's designer's manual. From chapter 14 about, you know, honoring people and taking care of them, for me, it's in chapter, I think it's chapter one, was that he said that idea, I think, therefore I act. Well, no, you actually have to take action.
I was going to say that I think that idea that somehow, you know, somebody having these ruminations, you know, sitting in the proverbial ivory tower or literal ivory tower, I don't know, maybe they are, but, you know, sitting in the office or writing in a book, somehow just because they've sort of articulated this idea that it's a done deal is, I think it's a bit of a sort of elevated sense of your own importance, sort of like a just kind of self-indulgent exercise. And I think ultimately, you know, it comes down to, as you were just saying, you know, we have to do better. So, I mean, I think one of the things we have to stop doing is sort of wishing to do better or wishing to be better. You know, it's like, just be better, do better, you know, get out, do something. Everybody's not necessarily prepared or equipped to do the same thing. And we shouldn't expect everybody to be doing the same thing. You know, we have different experiences. We have different talents. We have different interests. We have different leanings. It's just a matter of finding out what it is that you do best and to just get down to doing that thing. And I, you know, I often quote this saying, you know, get in where you fit in. We don't necessarily fit in the same places. It's just, but it's a matter of finding out what best suits you. And whatever that thing is that you have to offer is needed. It's something that's valued. And it's something that is going to contribute to bringing about, you know, this other reality that hopefully if, you know, our hearts are in the right place and if our actions are done well, if we do them to the best of our ability, we'll be able to get to a better place than where we are now.
I think that's a perfect place for us to bring this 6+ hours of conversation to a close. Thank you, Ramis, for all your time and being generous with me in this conversation. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Scott, for doing this. And you're providing a very important service for us. So thank you.
And that was Ramis Kent. When putting the first two episodes for this series together, I thought that I would end with a monologue, but I don't have one. For everything that we covered, they stand on their own. So my final thoughts from the series are this. To take care of one another, we must know each other. Sometimes that is easy, when we are with people like ourselves. Sometimes that is hard, when we don't have the means to understand a person or their background. But through a dialogue, a conversation, we can begin down the road of knowing them. So until the next time we're together, reach out and get to know someone better than you already do, so we can truly create the world we want to see.
If there's any way I can help you, let me know. Call 717-827-6266 or send me an email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com. Through our actions, we can create a world that cares for the earth, ourselves, and each other.